Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at wbez.org/events.
From WBEZ Chicago, this is Nerdette Recaps His Dark Materials with Peter Sagal. I'm Greta Johnson.
And I'm Trisha Bobita.
And we are joined by Peter Sagal.
Hello. Greta was just pointing out to me before we started that I haven't been taking a lot of notes.
Well, you showed up with notes this time, which I don't think I've
more
seen you do in
recapper
several weeks.
Been.
Greta, could you help paint a picture for me? Is it like a long scroll as if we were in a medieval?
It's an iPad.
It's one page on an iPad screen. Right. But I want everybody to know that among my notes and whinges, mostly whinges, there's one that's in all caps.
Mm.
And I want you guys to guess when I whinge it, which that one is.
You don't write in. I just, all my stuff is in all caps.
Well, you handwrite. You have lovely handwriting. My handwriting is illegible, so I type all my notes. So
but
I have to
use all caps all the time.
Yeah, no.
I mean, the bear CGI is great. Ready me for battle. Holy shit, this poor woman. Those were all in all caps.
Those are your all caps notes.
Those are my all caps notes. Yeah, I have other notes. But
I'm
going
to make you guess what
in.
Mine was when we get to it.
Great. I'm looking forward to that. Okay, so today we're recapping season one, episode 7 of His Dark Materials. It was called The Fight to the Death, which makes a lot of sense having now seen it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I thought this episode was remarkable for a number of reasons, but mainly because of like the quick back and forth between Lyra's world and our world.
Yeah.
I thought it was really interesting how quickly they would do these like tiny scenes in Will's world and then go back to it.
It was interesting as one word. I that generally threw me. The rhythm of it seemed odd.
I kind of liked the dissonance between them. I thought it was really interesting how quickly you could tell if we were in Svalbard or if we were in our world.
Yes.
Because the, you know, like even the kind of like milky glass that was in the front door of Will's house.
Yeah.
Like you could just immediately tell like, oh, yep, we're not in the bear castle
yeah,
anymore.
So you're giving them credit for being able to really distinguish between an actual set and a CGI bear palace.
I am.
Okay.
Yeah, I thought it was great. And it also makes me think that instead of actually doing that in this recap where we jump back and forth, we should just discuss what happens in our world in Will's storyline and then get to the bear CGI.
I like your
that
thing.
Would help my brain, I think. I did enjoy actually watching it. It does also make me think in terms of the way the pacing is changing and cutting between worlds that we're closer
pacing,
than ever before
yes.
to them smashing together in some
yes.
exciting way.
Which I thought was cool. But Peter wasn't into it. So
I was into it.
Well, good. I'm glad that's majority rules.
So. Where has it not around here?
Okay, so the Our World storylines. We have Boreal. We've got him like sitting in the van watching John Perry videos.
How many creepy guys does he have with him? Just one?
He's got two creepy
mustaches.
He's
got two creepy guys. Do they look vaguely similar?
Yeah, they both have weird mustaches.
I had trouble keeping them separate.
I thought they were just one person until this episode, I believe, actually.
Yeah, one is the guy who he originally met and who, like, he went to his house, right? And they met in the coffee shop and then they were at, I think, his house. And then the other guy seems to be also mustached.
Well, is also mustache.
Yeah. I have some questions.
Okay.
So the plot is about Boreal trying to finally get the letters. Here are the questions.
Yeah.
Why didn't he do this two episodes ago when the letters were established and he found out about them? I'm not sure if it was two episodes ago, but it was a while ago.
Well, he didn't find out about them then. Will found out about them.
So is this then
he
when
didn't
he's
find
looking
out about them until he was sitting in this van watching the same YouTube video?
Yes,
of
when
the
he's
hot
when he's when he's when he's watching the
again.
Hot Priest video.
Yeah. Hot Priest YouTubes.
Hot Priest YouTube. Hot Priest Tube. He's watching that.
Nope.
And he says, oh my gosh, there are letters. I shall go back to the house. So he doesn't know about the letters, these letters that we've heard so much about until that moment. Is that the theory?
I think that's the theory. Yeah. Right?
That's how I read it. And also, like, they have tapped or wiretapped or whatever, you know, put some sort of software on their computers, which is, I think, how they're finding out things about, like, their bank accounts and all this other stuff. So I kind of read it as because Will had watched it, he was seeing what Will was doing on his computer, and that's how he even found the video in the first place. But maybe I read into that more than there was.
I like that, though. That's giving some credit.
There was a prior bit with one of these creepy guys with a mustache. It turns out he's a computer guy, which is why he's so pale and sallow, and he had apparently found out about the bank accounts, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So here's another question.
Now I'm imagining a very tanned, creepy mustached man.
Not going to find one. So they're all, I mean, it's like absolutely rule of Hollywood TV. All computer guys have to be pale and sallow.
Okay.
Yeah. They used to be chubby, but they've moved away from that stereotype, which I appreciate.
Most sort of CBS crime shows actually now have like a sassy lady IT person.
That's also nice.
Yeah.
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah.
Here's the second question. So, all right, we knew about the letters. He didn't know about the letters till now. Great. Why does he decide to go get the letters by trying to walk into the house when the mom is there rather than doing what, of course, they're going to do and they do later, which is break in and steal them
and
when they're not home?
Also, when Boreal shows up at Elaine's house and like tries to sweet talk her out of the letters.
Yeah.
It did make me think like, why? Like, he could also use force, right?
We've had that conversation before when he approached her on the street.
Well, he didn't ask about the letters at that point. He has a specific ask this time around, which is like, okay, fine. But also, like, if you knew about a gateway to a whole nother universe that you actually were from and you were just visiting in this one, why wouldn't you just like whack her over the head? I guess because you don't know where the letters are.
And also, he lives in another universe. So what are we to him? You know, it's not like he's going to get caught. He'll go back through the door.
Yeah, he'll
and
be fine.
And he works for this insanely evil organization called the Magisterium. In fact, we've seen him kill somebody.
Or at least almost kill.
Well, she's never come back.
Yeah, the journalist with the butterfly demon.
Right.
Yes.
And if that's the kind of person we're dealing with, why doesn't he just walk in and shoot her in the head or something? That's the kind of evil we're supposed to believe he is. It seems strange. Why are they doing this?
It was weird. I did think the moment when his snake demon kind of peeks out of his shirt and she
creepy.
Says something about it and then he gaslights her was super f***ed up.
Yeah. But although, again, if he wants to get the letters, he doesn't care about her per se. Right? Why does he care about her? Why doesn't he say, yes, that's my snake. I'm a scary person. Give me the letters and my snake will bite you.
I think
why is it necessary?
Like, because...
So hang on, Peter. So you're suggesting that you would have preferred dialogue of, this is my scary snake, it will bite you.
Exactly. Well, as opposed to, because that would make sense that he's actually trying to threaten and get whatever he wants from her, as opposed to once again trying to protect this false identity he has as it's apparently some sort of British security agent.
Yeah.
Why is that important? What does that get him?
I mean,
I don't know. When his motivation to go right there is just to get the damn letters.
There is some emotional manipulation that I think makes sense from a creepo.
Yeah, but not from a larger story point of view. He doesn't need to manipulate her. He needs to get the letters.
You're so upset.
I think that the letters are a clue, but he also probably thinks that she knows more than is written in the letters. The fact that this money keeps getting doled out to her, I think he assumes that the letters have information, but that she also is a valuable source of information that only exists in her head. So if she's knocked out or killed or something else, he's less likely to figure that out. And she seems so fragile that he's probably still thinking it might work to just get her to tell him everything that she knows, which may or may not also be in the letters.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you have to make that up. You have to make that up to justify the scene. It's not there. But I will not. I will stop whinging. I have.
Will you? You're whinged out at the moment.
I stopped whinging about that scene. There are more scenes to come.
Do you think is now the time? Yeah. Okay. So I want to give full credit to Brendan Banaszak for finding this, and we're gonna go back in time for a second, Peter.
This isn't going to end well for me.
I'm really glad we're getting voicemails and that you're playing them for us, Greta, because it actually, it sort of humbles me a little that I'm sort of, you know, criticizing this thing because it's not as skillful as Game of Thrones or it's not as well acted or it's not as... This is a kid's TV show based on a kid's book.
Yeah, chill out, Peter.
Yeah, I remember that. And I thought of that again. I remember that, and I feel like Samuel L. Jackson at the end of Pulp Fiction. I'm trying to be the shepherd, but it's hard, Ringo. It's really hard.
I feel it's reminiscent of in Parks and Recreation when Ron Swanson is going to get back together with Tammy too, and the only way they can try to convince him not to is to play video of himself explaining to Ron why Ron shouldn't do that.
Yes. Yes, which was great.
God.
Talk about it. You're right, and I continue to whinge, but there was a moment later on in the episode. It was the scene between Serafina and Lee, the only one they've got in this episode, where I was watching this listening to this dialogue, and I said to myself, who are they writing for? Because adults won't buy this dialogue. It's leavened with bullshit, if I can say that. But kids won't like it either. I just felt that a number of times in this show, it seems they think they're making it for someone dumber than they are, but they're not quite sure who that person is.
I mean, the mere fact of it airing, like ostensibly being a kid's show, but airing at 9 p.m.
Yeah.
is kind of an interesting like contradiction of terms. Yeah.
And a young adult book, but a very dark young adult book.
Yes. Right. Which again, as I've mentioned, at least to me, was much of its appeal. How much that Philip Pullman, the author of the books, trusted his young readers to go to pretty dark places.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you're not wrong. I will say that.
That's as close as she's ever going to come,
ladies
and gentlemen.
Yeah. So, okay. So Will finds out his dad's alive.
Yes.
Or his dad could be alive, yes. I guess is a better way of putting mm-hmm. it. And what else do we have? His house is ransacked.
Not quite. They break in, but he manages to trick the guy to falling over.
Well, but the first time he comes home with his mom, right? His mom comes and meets him at school. Yeah. She's freaked out because the dude with the snake. And he's like, Mom, this is wild, but okay. They go back home. Somebody's rummaged through the house pretty intensely.
Right.
So he takes his mom to, was it the wrestling coach? The boxing coach.
It took me a while to figure who that was.
He takes his mom to the boxing coach, leaves her there for safekeeping, goes back to the house to clean up. And he grabs the letters, and it's like right as he's about to read the letters, right, that he hears the front door open.
Right. Somebody's coming back.
Can we just pause? Because I thought the line that the boxing coach said of, I have some spare pajamas.
Oh, yeah, that was.
Was particularly odd.
Yeah. It was like, well, thank God that was the continuity issue that we were worried about.
I didn't have appropriate nightwear, sleepwear. Now we do. I can stay here. Anyway. So if they've ransacked the place, then why are they coming back?
Because they didn't find the letters. Because they're in that cool sewing machine.
Yes. And he defeats the evil guy by scaring him into falling backwards over a railing.
Yeah, he accidentally kills him.
You think he's dead?
I think he's dead.
Oh.
I'm pretty sure that is from the books. And I just forgot about it until it happened.
I haven't read the second book, which is where Will Perry appears, so I don't know.
Could be wrong about that, but I think so. Anyway, so, and then the last scene we have of him essentially is walking past the boxing coach's house.
Right.
Not going to see his mother and with a backpack full of stuff. So like ostensibly he's running away.
Yeah, ostensibly he's running away, or he's running away to find his father or to we don't know. So let me ask our control, Trish, a question. Do you find all of this interesting? Do you find Will Parry, the boy?
Like 100%?
Like, oh, wow, what an interesting young man. I'm very interested to find out what happens next. Or are you waiting around to find out why this is important?
I mean, I know enough to know that I was told by a bird demon that he's important. So I trust the narrator.
Did you do some Googling on that one?
Well, no, his fate is tied to...
Yeah. Oh, you mean a literal bird demon.
Yeah, Serafina's demon.
Did you think that was my shorthand for Twitter?
Yeah, I thought you were euphemizing
Twitter.
Yeah,
Twitter is my bird demon. I hate Twitter too much for it to be my demon.
That's hilarious.
No, but like, so, you know, I've been told, and I also like have picked up even from the very first episode, people were like, check it out in this moment in the opening credits. You can see Will up these stairs while Lyra goes down these stairs. And so I know that he is about to be very important. But yeah, it's like a slower boil towards, you know, something very, very interesting happening to him. But because his dad is Andrew Scott, I'm like, oh, this is going to be fun and important. I think that he's actually doing a really nice job of portraying someone who's still a kid, but is clearly has to care for a parent. Yeah. So he's like an interesting, nuanced character to me that way. And I still don't really understand Boreal. Like, I'm much more interested, actually, honestly, in Will Perry and Elaine, because I just think that the acting has been really nice and all that, than I am sort of worried about them and their fate because of Boreal, because I just still don't understand why Boreal is obsessed with
Grumman.
Andrew Scott, with
or
Grumman.
John Perry, yeah.
With the many-named man.
Yes.
The many-named man. Yeah, he's pretty much just a creeper.
Because, like, he already knows how to cross between worlds, so...
Yeah, why does he need him?
Yeah.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
Okay, should we go to
Is there anything left
Svalbard?
To be said about our world at this point?
I know. I mean, do you have any other complaints you'd like
complaints?
To officially
yes.
register?
No. And they could never afford that house. Move on.
That house is much nicer than the apartment they're in the books.
Yes.
Okay, so we're going to rewind back to the beginning of the episode. Will you do that again, please?
No.
Okay, so we had that amazing pre-credit scene with Mrs. Coulter back in Bullvanger.
Yes, looking at the machine going, I knew I shouldn't have put in the thing where you push all the buttons, it blows up. Darn it! Who would ever thought someone would push all the buttons?
Oh, my God. But she also screams like a very scary
Is that the second or third time she's done that? I think it's the third.
Yeah.
And she's just screamed. And I'm wondering if they've gone to that well a little much.
to have the
villain of the piece, the person who we're supposed to fear, just seem unhinged sometimes.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I kind of liked it. And then that conversation she had with Cora, I thought
that was some conversation.
And like they cut out your demon, not your brain, and Cora repeating the same stuff over and over.
And then she strangles her?
Yeah.
I thought she was going to kill her like the Nazi in Inglourious Basterds, just wring her neck, but she didn't. And again, it just seemed like she's just so impetuous and angry and not in control of herself, which is a note for a character, I guess. I don't remember that from the book. I don't know if it's a positive one. I kept thinking about how like there's for when specifically when talking about villains, there's good crazy and bad crazy. So like good crazy is Ramsay Bolton.
One of the like most terrifying villains from Game of Thrones.
Yes. And what I mean by that is like his craziness makes him scarier because he has no morals. He'll do anything at any time.
That's good crazy?
Well, I mean good crazy in the sense like it makes for a good villain. If a villain is crazy in a good villainous way that makes you know, villains have a purpose to play. You're supposed to fear them and worry about what they're going to do to the heroes.
And like in Ramsay's mind, everything he's doing is on purpose. It's like a meticulous evil.
Yeah. While this kind of crazy just makes her seem unbalanced. And just, again, I used the word I used last week when I was talking about their version of the rescue scene. Weak. She just seems sort of like weak and at the mercy of events and just not a particularly scary villain.
I mean, I think that nuance is actually something that I don't mind because it makes them less a Bond villain and more just another character who is complicated.
Yeah, and I don't think she's supposed to be a scary villain.
And I think it reinforced for me the idea that because she is somebody who cannot control her emotions, she's sort of at 0 or 100 miles per hour. And that makes this whole idea of her thinking her demon is the reason she feels these feelings and that's why she hates her demon and that's why she wants to sever people from their demons is because she thinks it would be a cure to this thing that is a problem for her, which is having, you know, mitigated emotions.
Yes. I can see that. I don't buy it, but I can see it. I think that's a coherent argument.
Okay, so from there, Lyra lands in the what we called last week the Theon and Sansa snow, a reference to them jumping off in Winterfell.
Apparently, one thing we haven't been able to do, film and television industry has come up with really convincing fake snow yet. Mm. It all looks like laundry detergent.
Isn't that usually what it is? It's like soap flakes or something?
Soap flakes, yeah. It just doesn't look cold. It doesn't look like it melts. It just doesn't look like snow. Yeah. But that's another story.
But we know she survived her fall from the balloon.
Onto the Theon
snow. And she sees a bear.
Yes.
And she's like, oh, great. It's my friend Yorick, who I spoon all the time.
Yes.
And it's a terrifying armored bear who is not her spoon buddy at all.
Right.
I like that she yells really loud and then Pan goes, yeah, maybe don't.
I know. I love like Pan as the voice of caution all the time. He's just like, seriously, like you're going to be that reckless? Are you sure?
Were you happy that you got your bears, Trish? You said you'd be willing to give up demons if you got lots of bears.
I got some bears.
You did.
I got great many bears.
Yeah, I thought they were pretty impressive.
They were very impressive.
Yeah, the CGI is very good. Very cool.
Okay, so we go to bear prison.
Mm-hmm.
She goes straight to jail, and she meets that super crazy guy.
Right. The super crazy academic who is in the book. He is a slightly longer scene, but his purpose is more or less the same, which is that he gives Lyra the most important piece of information, which is essentially that...
Let's listen to it.
Yorick should have been king, but was disgraced and exiled. He will never be allowed back in the palace. Hatred is a powerful motor. And King Yopa hates every inch of Yorick. You're stuck here, as am I. Till you wilt, or they break you.
Trisha, do you remember, it's been a very long time since I saw Aladdin, but is there a character who kind of reminds...
Yes, there is this prisoner who it turns out is the evil vizier in disguise who tells Aladdin that he needs to go get this lamp.
Wow, you remember that
I had young children watch that movie a lot.
Yeah, but that would have been a while ago.
I know. True, but nonetheless, I remember. Yes, there is a prisoner. Okay. And what's different is in Aladdin, that prisoner has a strong motivation for giving that exposition. In this, he's just like, why it's to steal a joke from Austin Powers, it's Professor Exposition. But actually, that was weirdly not the exact bit of information, although all that was important, that I was thinking of when I said the important bit of information, which is to remind us that Yofur, the evil bear king, wants a demon, wants to be human, which inspires Lyra's whole scam, which is direct from the
book. You can't trick a bear, but a bear who wants so badly to be human
can be tricked. Mm-hmm. Yes, and so she comes up with this plan to trick him.
It's a very good plan.
It's a very good plan. So this is straight from the book, so I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the fact that they kept that, you know, intact. But did you buy it? Did it make sense to you that Yofur would be fooled that way?
I guess if no one had ever thought that you could sever a human from their demon before, but that's what they were doing with Mrs. Coulter, then why not add demons? Yeah, I mean, it's all outlandish enough that it would make sense. And also, she's a child, so it's also sort of like, how did this little girl get here unless this is true, right? Like, it's sort of a bear who wants to believe certain things and is sort of, you know, I mean, sometimes people get into positions of power, right? And they maybe believe what they're told instead of questioning it. And maybe they will sort of blindly seek whatever it is they want at the expense of anyone around them. I have no parallels in our world for leaders like this.
Uh-huh. Right,
but I think that, like, some big bears who are kind of dumb would probably fall for this.
Probably.
Do you think it's fair to say that any leader who yells, "Ready me for battle," is kind of inept and lame?
I love that.
Really?
Oh, it's great. I yell that all the time. Nobody ever does anything. I yell that every morning when I get up and go to work. Uh-huh. Ready me for battle!
And they put your bicycle helmet on you?
Exactly. Exactly.
She
my
just
bicycle helmet
it in
with
direction.
my little rear view mirror for safety.
So we did get some voicemails about the question we put out regarding,
which is,
if the bear CGI made it worth the lack of demons.
Okay.
So let's listen.
Hi, Peter, Trisha, and Greta. My name's Amina in, sorry, that's my dog snoring, in Central Valley of California. If I had a demon, I have come to the conclusion it would be a hooded crow. As to your question about team demon or like team CGI bear, I'm totally cool sacrificing CGI demons to have more CGI bears because the bears are like chef's kiss, like what I'm most jazzed about. But it's a bummer that the reality of that is sacrificing development between demon human relationships.
Yeah.
Really enjoying the podcast, really enjoying all of Peter's whinging. You are the mouthpiece for me. And so don't stop. Thanks.
I guess that's a different kind of appeal for people. It's like, for my entertainment, I will watch a television show I don't like and then listen to a podcast in which somebody explains why I don't like it.
I should have had Justin edit that out so that wasn't in there.
Yeah, sorry.
Let's listen to another opinion from Carrie. Justin, if there's any praise of Peter, can we just skip over?
Isn't that a general rule we have?
Hi, Nerdette and Peter. This is Carrie calling from Maine. My demon would be a saw-wet owl.
Oh.
And I'm calling because I just finished your episode in which you asked if we were okay with the lack of demons, if it meant bears. And I am, I guess, I really just want more of everything. I do not want to sacrifice the bears. But I do think that the lack of demons is really problematic. It frustrates me so much because the fact that the kids were not, you know, looking to their demons for comfort when they were in Mulvanger, all of that just, it makes it harder to understand the stakes, I think. Anyway, I have a lot of feelings about this. I did say to my boyfriend when we were watching that if they had hired me as a demon consultant, it would have been a lot better. But I am still really enjoying the show. I'm really enjoying listening to all of you. So thank you so much. And I can't wait for next week.
I do wish there was someone in the credits listed as Demon Wrangler.
Yeah, that would be cool. Demon Consultant.
And then like the ASPCA, no demons were harmed in the making of this.
Carrie, that was a great voicemail. But next time, just pull over, girl.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't risk your life in order to whinge about this TV show. I wouldn't.
We have one more voicemail that is on this topic, so I think we should just play it right now. This is Debbie, who's providing kind of an alternate viewpoint.
Well, hello, Nerdette and Peter. This is Debbie. I live here in Chicago. My demon would probably be that little yellow finch that eats all my sunflowers off my porch every summer. Speaking of demons, if you had not said something about where are all the demons, I don't know that I would have even noticed. The ones you do meet are so sort of interesting and charming that, I don't know, I get sidetracked easily. Why don't they have actual live animals as stand-ins? They don't have to talk. And that would give us a sense that, like, oh, look, there are everybody's demons, dogs and cats and hedgehogs and ferrets, that you could actually use real animals for and then not have to pay for all that CGI. It's a thought.
I wouldn't be surprised. I noticed when they were toward the end of the episode in the scene in the hangar where they seemed to be arming themselves for a big battle with lots of guns. I didn't know they had guns like that, but be that as it may. I noticed there were a bunch of characters in the background walking with, I assume, dog demons.
Yeah.
Who look like dogs.
Yeah.
And I actually wondered at that moment, are those real dogs?
Yeah.
Because you could easily, like, just walk along with a dog, even on a leash, and erase the leash, and that would probably be a lot easier.
Well, and I did notice in the Bullvinger episode last week, like, there are just a lot of dog and bird demons, I think, because it's easy to put them on screen relatively.
Yeah, and remember, PETA has called out the show for using real animals, and they were arguing that, you know, that's not necessary because CGI exists and they don't want anyone to sort of put animals through unnatural things on set. And so, yeah, some of the dogs, I think, are definitely real. I don't know if any of the birds are, but they are definitely sometimes just using dogs.
Yeah.
Well, and it is, you know, animal welfare issues aside, it is kind of hilarious to picture if there were just like ferrets and hedgehogs and snakes.
Yes,
and
that would be hilarious.
Like a whole, and like all of a sudden then, you know, you've got your extra in the background like dropping the hedgehog on accident or something. I don't know. It seems like it could introduce a lot of issues. But
yeah, I guess so.
And then you got to get hedgehogs union cards. And how do you do that?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, that's just a lot of
union hedgehogs.
Speaking of
the
wrangling.
Worst. They're so prickly. Anybody?
Good one.
Anybody? Doing what we can here to provide entertainment. Moving on.
So I'm very curious to hear what both of you thought of the fight to the death scene. Not only because the CGI was, in fact, amazing, but I thought they made a really interesting choice of not actually showing Yorick killing Yofur and just showing Lyra kind of at the forefront hearing it and being traumatized by it.
I have strong feelings about this, so Trish, why don't you go first?
Well, first of all, why were the armored bears not wearing their armor to fight in?
Oh, you mean the thing I wrote in all caps in my notes
when I wrote,
the armored bears fighting without armor?
You're not even going to back up
that,
off that mic,
Trisha?
Huh?
Literally everybody in this studio, there are three other people, they all backed away from me.
Well, we were just hoping you would actually back off that mic if you're going to start yelling, dude.
Yes. I mean, Yorick runs up wearing his armor. Oh, great. You've arranged this fight to the death. First thing I do, take off the armor.
Well, it does raise the question of what ready me for battle means.
Yes, exactly. Ready me for battle. Take off my armor.
I can see how the armor is an unfair advantage, right? It's like it's hand-to-hand combat. It's like you don't get your fancy weapons or protection.
But they're armored bears. They don't have weapons. They have armor.
Right, and they don't get to use the armor during the fight to the death. I think that's reasonable.
As Irene Adler says in BBC Sherlock, you know, I'm going to wear my battle suit, and by that she means she's going to be naked in the fight. So, you know,
yes.
To the Brits, readying for battle.
Maids taking off all their clothes. Missed that in Dunkirk. The thing, I'm sitting there going, why did they do that? Did someone make a choice? If they made a choice, why didn't they put that into the show? Something like, you know, Yorick saying, we do this without our armor. Or was it yet another question of the CGI budget? Is it that harder?
No, it can't be.
It can't be. Why is it harder to animate two bears fighting with armor than without? It just made no sense to
me. Is it in the books?
No, in the books, they fight with armor.
With armor.
In fact, this is why I have strong feelings about it. It is perhaps my favorite scene in the book. Not only because I'm a boy and I like fights. But there's something
I'm a
about
boy and I like
stereotypes.
Yeah,
you know what? You know,
my
do you want to just
my
wait
daughter
for a second?
The patriarchy speaking, so ladies be quiet. Peter Sagal is the worst.
We had a toxic masculinity jingle.
Yeah, we do.
When my youngest daughter was about six, she described boys' tastes and things.
Uh-huh.
And she said, they're just like blah, blah, violence, blah, blah, violence. And I'm like, she's so right. There's something about that scene in the book that's great. For one thing, it's written in such a way that you don't know Yorick's going to win. And that sort of...
Yeah, I thought that kind of played out in the
beat in which he seems defeated. But also just the
being dragged by his throat.
Yeah, that was bad. That was good. That was fine. But the intensity of the relationship between Lyra and Yorick, there's this moment where Lyra is convinced that Yorick is about to die and she wants to look away, but she says that no, she will look at him so that if he looks to her, he will see her. I believe the phrase is eyes shining with love, and it's actually moving.
Yeah.
And so I was very excited about this scene. And it was better than some other things in this that I have, you know, been disappointed in. But the lack of armor made me a little crazy. And also the end of the fight is extremely violent. Yorick, with a huge swipe of his paw after he's, again, lured Yofur into thinking he's wounded.
He plays possum, right?
Yes, he does. Very large possum. He basically smashes off Yorick's jaw. And then rips his throat out and then eats his heart, because that's what bears do. And right, you're not going to show that. It's a kid's show. And it's one thing to describe it in a kid's book, another thing to show it in a kid's show. But there was something very savage about the way the bears deal with each other that made them seem alien and scary, even Yorick, which is part of his appeal. He's a scary guy. Mm.
You know what it reminded me of was Grizzly Man. Did you see that?
You mean the Grizzly Man where the guy... gets eaten by the bears?
Where he gets eaten by the bears, but when they do the documentary about it, the filmmaker doesn't play the tape that they have of this guy getting eaten by bears.
It was Werner Herzog, right?
Yes. It's just him listening to the audio of the man getting... We don't hear the audio. He is sort of like the lens through which we hear the audio.
Yeah, and that I think, given the needle they had to thread, which is this is a violent act, but we don't want to put a lot of blood in.
I thought it worked pretty well.
They're not going to do a Game of Thrones, you know... spurts of blood for this kid's TV show. So I thought that was a good dodge.
Okay. Right when we come back, I'm going to put Trisha on the spot about something. So Trisha, you mentioned when we were discussing the bear fight that he was playing possum, which seems like... quite an interpretation.
Yeah.
How'd you know that, bud?
Because he seemed very hurt and then he was not hurt. Or not that hurt.
I see.
Is there something happening here that I don't understand? Because Greta has a smile on her face that I can't quite comprehend.
I mean... Is it important to you, Greta, that this happens?
Yep, it is. I think it's time to come clean.
I read the book.
Oh!
I couldn't help it. I've been pretending for weeks. Yeah. For weeks, Peter.
Weeks you've been pretending. Weeks? When did you read the book?
Like over Thanksgiving.
Oh!
And it turns out it really bothers
Greta. You trust people.
I know.
I feel like a bear. I have been tricked.
I've been complicit in the lie, and I don't like it.
Oh, well, we've all come clean. I'm going to need to take a minute. I can't. What couldn't you stand? You couldn't stand me being like, well,
yeah, it was probably you being like, you know, the book is a long time.
Yeah, I know. I would drive myself crazy. I would have done it myself if I had to deal with me. But was it or that, or were you just desperate to find out what happens next?
It was a situation where the circumstances were I went home for Thanksgiving and my mom was in the midst of reading the book. So there was sitting the copy right next to me.
How can you resist?
And, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm two time zones away from where I normally live. And so I'm staying up later than everybody else. And it's just sitting there staring at me. And so I picked it up and started reading. And then I was like, I'm just going to read up to where we are in the show. And then I don't actually have enough willpower to do that. So I finished the book.
At that point, you were lost. We know you.
Yeah. I come by it honestly. In my family, we literally have on many occasions, like whatever date in December everyone has finished their Christmas shopping, we just wrap and then unwrap all our presents. Like we're just not good.
Yeah, I understand. You're not good at waiting.
We're not good at waiting.
It's not a Bobita thing.
That's funny. It's like the anti-procrastination.
Yeah.
Like, let's all do it now.
Because rereading the book in my case.
Peter has so many questions.
Yeah, it really changed how I was dealing with the TV show. I'm not sure for the better. So did it change your view of the TV show?
It did make me really appreciate the world of these stories more because the writing is brilliant and it's really rich. And just, you know, the ways that the two mediums are different, I think, and make, you know, moving a story from one to the other difficult become really apparent, because so much of what the narrator can do nimbly and artfully in the books is hard to do in the show. It made me sort of, in some ways, more empathetic towards the showrunners, because they're trying to take something that I understand even better now why it's so beloved as a piece of fiction and put it in a medium that just isn't a perfect match for the way this story is told.
Yeah. I'm going to call that the higher road.
That is a very high road. I can almost see it from way down here where I am.
Should we listen to some audio?
Sure.
Should we listen to Yorick talking to Lyra, renaming Lyra? Mm.
You helped me get my kingdom back. You're one of us now, Lyra, and I will give you a new name. You're no longer Lyra Balakwa, but Lyra Silvertongue.
Lyra Silvertongue.
Lyra Silvertongue.
Does anyone ever, you hear a Yorick talk, you kind of stick your jaw out and...
No, I do not do that. No? Do you do that, Trisha?
I don't think I do.
Anybody else does, write in.
So Yorick takes over Svalbard.
He does, and immediately leaves, which, as Trish knows, he does in the book, and I had the same question. Why is he leaving? He just took over, man. You got things to do. You have, like, orders to give.
Yeah. He's got to at least reunite Lyra and Roger.
He does.
I want to see the bear small council meeting, though.
Yeah, there are. Yeah, it would be pretty interesting to see some more. To learn more about bear leadership. That was one thing I kind of had a gripe with, was, like, Yorick calls Yofur a tyrant.
Yes.
But, like, we haven't actually seen any of that. And I don't know, like, it might have been too much work in a scene to actually, you know, like, that would have taken a lot of time to prove. Oh, but it seems like there was something they could have done to, like, actually make it clear that the other bears were miserable under this dude who was so obsessed with becoming a human, essentially.
In the book, as Trish knows, they make a really big deal of how Yofur, the tyrant king, has built this palace in the manner
of humans. Right, because it's not their natural habitat.
Yeah, the bears don't live in palaces, and they make a big deal of that. And there's this great note, because he's having them eat their meat inside. All these animals and scavengers have come into the throne room. So he's got this throne room, which is supposed to be a human throne room, but it's covered in bird, like, guano
animal
refuse,
right?
Because it's just not right. It's not how bears are supposed to live. And that image in the book totally does what you just asked for, to show us why he's such a terrible,
tyrannical
king.
They're all against their nature.
Yeah,
in this.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then what does he do when he says, we shall now be bears again? What do? They take off their helmets. As if that's the problem.
But they are armored bears.
They're armored bears. They're supposed to have their armor.
They just wanted to look each other in the face for a second.
I feel strongly about the armors, the bear,
I can tell.
I feel strongly about the bear's armor. The armor of the armored bears.
You want to try it one more time? Just.
Greta, I feel strongly about the armored bear's armor. There we are.
We did it. We got there. Our next scene is Mrs. Coulter talking to Father, is it MacPhail?
I think she calls him MacPhail.
I think that's another important moment to listen to.
Well, MacPhail, I need to come with you.
Have you not listened to anything I've said? You've already endangered enough.
I know him. You know I do. I can smell his next move. And I know dust. I've studied it. Please don't deny the Magisterium my help.
I seek only devotion to the Magisterium.
Magisterium has my devotion.
You do understand what I'm saying? Lord Asriel needs to die.
Is this not the second time that we've seen Mrs. Coulter plead, cajole, demand a member of the Magisterium to let her continue? We saw it before. There was that scene in that small room that maybe had the alethiometer in it. I don't remember. But this is, again, another scene we've seen before, just like Lord Boreal and Will's mother.
It's a similar scene, but this time they're like, okay, but you actually have to kill that guy.
Yeah.
I think that's, like, the stakes are increasing. Like,
right.
Mm-hmm. She's asking to be forgiven again, and they're like, all right, but we're going to demand more out of you then.
Right. But it puts us in a weird position of, like, relating to this character. Is she someone we should feel sympathy for because she keeps screwing up and getting sidelined and punished? And thus we say, oh, no, she should get one more chance. to do an evil thing, to kill Lord Asriel? Or is she someone, and obviously my bias is towards this, who's supposed to be so powerful and scary, it's not that we're hoping she gets another chance to do her job, it's that we're afraid she will. And I would offer that at this point in this epic, we're supposed to be in the latter position regarding her.
I think she's scary because she's not powerful, and we know she'll do anything to get power, and she's unpredictable.
Yeah.
And... yeah, like that's what I think. It's actually worse that she doesn't have the power.
There's also like, because she's seemingly not a witch or some other species, she doesn't have the Serafina Pecola ways of, you know, swooping in and killing a lot of people. And we've now introduced sort of like SWAT team machine guns into the scenario.
Those look,
and like
those look rather our worldish.
Yeah.
I'm surprised to see those.
Which it also makes sense, though, that like a ruling authoritarian government would use a window between two worlds just for weapons.
Yeah, it's possible.
Which is disappointing, but seems about right. But, you know, she doesn't seem more powerful in terms of like if they just want him dead. And I guess, you know, that point might come up where it's like if they just wanted him dead, they could just like clearly drone strike his prison where he is instead of needing to get close to him. But if they just don't want to also destroy all his research, then they need to someone who can get close to him. And that's her power then, is like her womanly wiles will mean that she can get in the room with him because they have this history together, as opposed to just blowing everything up with a SWAT team.
Hmm. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, all I got to say is, all right, it's working for you. I'm glad.
I'm doing really like gymnastics to make the show more thoughtful than it might be.
That I think we all appreciate that. I think the show appreciates it.
Yeah. What do we have from there?
Well, we have the scene with Serafina and Lee Scoresby,
Serafina,
which I've already whinged about. It just, again, it's another conversation in which we are told, because they're talking about her in the third person, how important and wonderful and amazing and central to everything Lyra is, which I've already said is what you do when you're unable to justify that directly. You talk about it.
Yeah.
And again, Lee Scoresby's role in all of this is unclear. I don't think he appears in the book. Trisha, you would know better. You read it even more recently than I did. You liar. I don't think Lee Scoresby appears in the book after the balloon crash. I think he's like...
in Golden Compass?
Yeah, I think he's out of the picture because things proceed without him and his balloon is crashed.
I believe so, yeah.
So that scene seemingly was just to, let's get some more Lin-Manuel, who is our repository of charm.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get some more Serafina Pecola, which is a repository of really well-defined arms. And talk about Lyra, because that's what they do. This is the second conversation they've had, and it's the second conversation they've had about how wonderful Lyra is.
That's true.
Yeah.
Trisha, have you started The Subtle Knife yet?
Yes.
Okay, so after that scene, Lyra and Roger ride Yorick to the highest point in the mountain, to Asriel's lab.
Yes.
And... I want us to be careful not to give away spoilers on
this
one.
It's tricky.
But let's listen to the scene.
I did not send for you! You have to leave. You have to turn around and leave. I did not send for you.
I came here to free you.
No. No, you have to get out before I...
Asriel.
You didn't come alone. Who are you?
Watch pastor, sir. I work in the kitchens at Jordan College.
Thorold, prepare these children a hot bath and make them some food. Roger Parsler, I am very pleased you came.
So, finally, we have arrived at a place where I shall not whinge. Because
really?
I thought that scene, and maybe it's
God.
James McAvoy.
What a relief.
I know. I'm relieved, too. Was just as good, even better. Because
I thought
James
it
McAvoy,
was better.
Yeah. It's like that is as creepy. That should be as
and
creepy as it was.
Foreboding and like unclear what exactly is going on, but like it can't be good.
Yeah. And maybe you can guess like what he's been doing up there and why he's happy to see Roger Parslow. But all of that was great. Yay. I have nothing critical to say.
Wow. Now Trisha's going to be pissed.
I love James McAvoy.
No? Okay, great.
Yeah.
Whew.
He's great, by the way.
He's so good. I'm a big fan of him in lots
he
and lots
can
of
do
things.
Anything. Yeah.
Man, it's just so great to hear both of you say
positive things. It was good.
And agree with them.
Yeah.
That's just really exciting. I'm just so happy.
I got nothing to say. I'm just like, oh, it was very good. I enjoyed it. It was creepy. It's supposed to be creepy.
Maybe there should be something at the top of this episode that's like, and
if you
would like to hear people not whinge, skip ahead to minute 44.
Yes. It was such a positive podcast. It was only 4 minutes long.
Well, that means we've got one episode left.
Wow.
Which is pretty wild.
See, Trish, you ruined it. I was going to say.
Peter, it was not my idea to out myself.
I understand.
Yeah, but.
You were outed by your friend.
Okay, to be clear. But you did it, though.
I was going to say, if you hadn't known what's coming next, because you hadn't at that point read the book, would you be excited to find out what happens in the climax?
Yeah.
And I guess so.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think they obviously set up a very interesting situation between Asriel and the two kids. Mm-hmm. I mean, Mrs. Coulter is ostensibly on her way with a bunch of weapons.
Yes, there might be a big gunfight. That might
York
be on its way.
York did say he's hanging around.
Yeah.
And we know the momentum between those two, like this changes between those two worlds makes you think that like something is about to come to a head.
We can't have spent this much time messing around in our world for there not to be a meeting of the two storylines at the end of this season. There has to be,
right? So, yeah, I think that's a pretty promising finale.
Yeah, I hope so.
I guess we'll find out.
We have no choice.
So that's our question for everyone listening is, as we come to the finale of season one, what do you think is going to happen? What do you hope happens? Whether you've read the books or not, like, we don't know where the show's going to end for the season. And we know there's only two seasons, right? So this is the end coming up of season one. There'll be a season two, and that will span all three of the original trilogy. So who knows exactly what's going to happen, but what do you want to happen?
Yes, leave us a voice memo by recording yourself. Tell us your name, your location, what your demon would be. You can record yourself on your phone and then email it to us at nerdatrecaps@gmail.com. The show is produced by us with help from Justin Bull. Our executive producer is Brendan Banaszak. He's also very good at going back to find things to use against Peter, which I appreciate very much.
I've always wanted a nemesis. Thank you.
Oh, shit. Our theme music was composed by Andrew Edwards of Blue Police Box Music. We are at Nerdette Podcast on Twitter. Trisha is Trisha Bobita. I am Greta M. Johnson. Peter is Peter Sagal. And you can also follow along with the hashtag Nerdette Recaps. All right. See y'all next week.
You bet.
Brendan, sorry I outed you, man.
You outed two of us real hard in this episode. I was just going to keep it to myself. I thought I was being real diligent.
Right. Note to self, do not involve Greta in any criminal conspiracies.
Yeah, no, for sure not.
You're just bad at it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.